Greetings, friends. Welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the film review podcast, where we review films.
Nice.
No gossip this week. My name is Whitney Seibold. I am a film critic, and with me, as always, is the resplendent and intelligent William Bibbiani. Introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is William Bibbiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs, and I'm only hazily aware of what resplendent means. I think it's good. Regal?
Yeah, is? Splend, it has splendid, splendidness
yeah.
is in there. That's the root. Right. It's the root form of that word.
I'll look it up later. Okay. Anyway, this week on Critically Reclaimed,
Critically Reclaimed.
Yeah, we're bringing it back.
Oh, that's what we should have called the Streaming Club.
Oh, shit, you're right.
That's a better name. We have a Streaming Club podcast where we watch older movies. Critically Reclaimed. We should have called it that. Oh, well, too late now.
No, it's not. It's our show. We can call anything we want.
Okay, maybe we'll...
I'm writing that down, and if it takes, like if like a week later we're like, hey, that's still clever, we might rename that show.
But here on Critically Acclaimed, we review new films, and we have seen four new films this week between the two of us.
Yep, we're reviewing the new releases The Suicide Squad, not to be confused with A Suicide Squad.
Not just, you're the Suicide Squad?
The new Sparks musical from director Leos Carax, starring Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, Annette. The new animated musical with songs by Lin-Manuel Miranda, Vivo. And the really hard-hitting documentary about all the wildfires that are going out of control right now. It's called Bring Your Own Brigade. So let's start with the film that is sort of like... It's the biggest, but like all everyone wants to talk about is how like, oh my God, can you believe the latest DC movie didn't make like a lot of money at the box office an opening weekend in the middle of a plague when it's also available on streaming at the same time.
Well, what I find curious is this whole series that colloquially referred to as the DCEU. Mm-hmm. This is the 10th or the 11th, depending on how many cuts of Justice League you count.
Mm-hmm. Or rather Joker counts, I think is also...
Oh, man. No, it's not part of the same series.
Whatever.
It's,
they're all kind of...
Characters out of that comic book company. At least half of these have come out of the gate with, quote, disappointing box office. Like, even a big hit like Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice...
Mm-hmm. Was expected to be a billion-dollar movie.
It was
a
gigantic movie in one weekend, and then it dropped off severely in the second weekend. Birds of Prey was considered kind of a disappointment. I think the only one that was kind of an unexpected runaway was Aquaman.
Aquaman made $1 billion, and I think people were at least pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, even Man of Steel was like considered to underperform.
Shazam didn't make a ton of money either. It was probably one of the most critically successful films in the series, but like it wasn't a $1 billion film.
I think it's also the lowest grossing of this series.
It might be, yeah. So this has been
it's my favorite of the series.
If you consider financial gross to be some sort of
bellwether
or indicator of quality, it's really hard to get a bead on these movies. But here's the thing, and I will say this over and over again until I run out of breath. Financial success has little or nothing to do with actual quality. Lots of terrible movies have made money. Lots of awful movies have struggled to find an audience until many years later in some cases. Some still haven't found a great audience.
Yep.
Our concern is the quality of the film, not whether it makes money. And especially right now, to have a conversation about like how a movie is doing at the box office as being some kind of indication of how the franchise is going, I think is entirely disingenuous.
Well,
there's so many X factors right now.
There's two things going on here. One is, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and... all of these blockbuster films, the studios are taking a bath. Even the films that are making pretty good money, like
Fast and Furious 9.
Fast and Furious or Black Widow.
It made $600 million, which is pretty good. It was expected to make $1 billion.
Exactly.
That was the plan. Yeah.
The studios are losing money on most of these.
Yeah.
Mulan was supposed to be a huge hit.
Yep.
They just dropped that on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
I think the game really changed back when Trolls World Tour came out right at the start of lockdown, and it made $100 million without going to theaters, and people realized, realized they could make a lot of money this way. Secondly, it's curious that a lot of people who are fans of these types of movies, the superhero fans, are used to the films they love being big hits. Yep. And when a film that they really love isn't, it causes a little bit of cognitive dissonance.
It feels like, a little personal, doesn't it? Like, wait a minute.
I thought we were all part of this gigantic tribe. We all love this thing and we're all going to go see it and it's all going to be a big hit.
Yeah.
And when it's...
We all agreed to make this a big hit.
When it's not as big a hit as any of the previous ones, it feels a little off to a lot of the fans.
I feel as though we've inherited a lot of sort of trepidation about how long these sorts of franchises are going to last, because for many, many years, comic book movies, with the exception of Superman and Batman, and even those two both had like two really big popular ones and like two that kind of underperformed. And in the case of Batman, it was 1 and 3. In the case of Superman, it was 1 and 2 were the ones that were considered big hits at the time. But regardless, there were like 4 of those movies. Only 2 of them did really, really great. And then they fell off, and then they got rebooted, and people don't want them rebooted. They want these things to go on forever. They want to, like, these are the ones we like, and we want them to stick around for forever. And they will. They're going to get rebooted. They're going to get recast.
Well, the
they're
going to
be fine. They're not going to stop making Batman movies. Yeah, they're not going to stop making these movies.
Or maybe they will, mercifully, someday.
Well, you know what I mean? My point is this. It doesn't fucking matter. These are giant... mega franchises. These are things that the studios know they can make a lot of money about. If they move to TV for a while, okay.
Yeah, and that's
fine. That happens too. And it's streaming.
Well,
or whatever.
What's going to happen? It's going to be a big blend. There's going to be some on TV, some on streaming. There's
Disney's
gonna be
doing
some
that
in
now.
Theaters.
I think they're moving further and further in that direction.
The Suicide Squad is a blended release. It's released in theaters and it's on HBO Max, as is going to be the case with all of the Warner Brothers hits this year. The Suicide Squad is. Sort of a sequel, but also kind of a redo of David Ayer's Suicide Squad, which was a big hit, but wasn't well received.
It made a ton of money, but my God, is it terrible. And it's another one where it's pretty much universally confirmed that this David Ayer shot a film, Warner Brothers had it like dramatically re-edited, and it's still obviously the same basic narrative, but apparently he was really unhappy with it.
Well, and I was unhappy with it too, because it's a bad film.
It's a very bad motion picture. The first like 30-40 minutes of that movie just reintroduces the characters like 4 times.
And there's all this really stupid, clunky exposition.
Nonstop montages. It's just the same three fucking helicopter explosions. And
It assumes so that we feel more about the characters than perhaps the film lets us know. It's like, this is Captain Boomerang. Am I supposed to know something about Captain Boomerang?
Yeah.
Captain Boomerang is back, as is Harley Quinn.
And Rick Flagg, played by Joel Kinnaman.
Rick Flagg
and Amanda Waller, played by Viola Davis.
Yeah, the premise is the same in the Batman Superman universe. There's a bunch of supervillains that have been apprehended and are in supervillain prison, and Viola Davis has offered them a chance to knock years off their sentence if they go on top secret missions, like assassination types of missions, to do like really bad guy kind of stuff.
Yeah, and apparently,
if they misbehave, there's bombs in their brains that she'll blow up,
just like Escape from New York. Yeah. One thing I kind of like about this new one is that in the original, this was like a new idea, and like a big chunk of the movie was her selling the government on being able to do this. In this one, it's like kind of like just an institution, and like towards the beginning when they're all going off on a mission, it's a whole bunch of new super criminals, all of whom are like pretty bargain basement bad guys, so you know that most of them are gonna die. And then Harley Quinn just shows up like, oh, hey, Harley, you back? Yep, doing another run.
Yeah.
So they arrested me for robbing a bank. I'm going to do a couple of these and then I'm out.
So she was, the last time we saw Harley Quinn, it was in the film Birds of Prey, and she was out of prison.
Yeah.
But now she's back, and she's back in prison.
Suicide Squad runs, and then she's back out in the open.
Which explains why
supervillains keep getting out of jail.
She just rolls with everything. I love it. And she's teamed up with a character named Bloodsport, who is played by Idris Elba. He has an Iron Man outfit with like weapons hidden all over it, so he can like pull off bits and build weapons like kind of out of thin air. There's a character called the Peacemaker, played by John Cena, who is
basically
super patriot guy who will murder everybody so long as there's peace at the end of it.
Yeah, he's basically like the worst case scenario Captain America type. Let's see, we've got Polka Dot Man.
These are, I'm sure, are all like really corny characters taken from
mostly,
the comics.
Mostly corny characters. Some of them were like more well respected than others. But he got Polka Dot Man. He shoots polka dots at people. You've got King Shark.
Who is a shark guy.
He was a shark guy who was voiced by Sylvester Stallone. And
kind of a very kind of cliched, big, dumb bruiser character with a shark head.
But dang if he isn't cute.
it's a shark. Sharks are cute. They look terrifying.
But he's wearing board shorts. How can you not love that?
This big, like, Hulk guy in board shorts.
If they make a King Shark plushie, I'd buy that. That's adorable. I want a King Shark.
Although, as a big, dumb bruiser, Sylvester Stallone's a good choice for the voice. A
great choice for the voice.
And there's an intro where we pan from...
Oh, sorry.
Like,
one more main character. Ratcatcher 2.
Oh, that's right. Ratcatcher 2, who is... whose father was mysteriously killed when he fell down an elevator shaft onto some bullets.
No, he actually died really tragically. The original rat catcher could control rats. Now his daughter is the new rat catcher, and she can control rats.
She's, like a magic wand that lets her communicate with rats.
And a bunch of other people who will all die really quick.
You might have heard how broad the cast is. They're not being talked about because they're not in the movie for very long. I do love the kind of devil-may-care attitude that James Gunn brought to that early sequence where everybody just sort of gets messily slaughtered. James Gunn infamously, came out of the Troma School. He wrote Tromeo and Juliet, probably his best film, before going on to making a really tragic superhero deconstruction film called Super,
which I think is really great, but it's fucked up.
It's hard to watch. It's so sad. Yeah. It sort of like lays into pretty heavily into like the mental illness required to be a superhero.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to put on an outfit and hit bad guys with a wrench. But when he hits somebody with a wrench, you get to see them like bleeding and screaming in pain.
Yeah. It's not fun violence. Yeah. It's actually horrific violence. That one's great. He also wrote a really, really good superhero comedy that nobody talks about called The Specials.
That's right. That was him, too. That was a really good film.
With Thomas Hayden Church and Rob Lowe and Jamie Kennedy and Judy Greer. And that's about like the fourth or fifth best superhero team in the world on their day off.
Yeah, so it's like one of them has like blue skin, but mostly they're just sort of hanging out and drinking and talking about their relationships.
There's like 10 seconds of an action sequence in that, and it's mostly someone beating up a pterodactyl off camera. it's really funny, though. Like, that movie is actually like full of like really good gags that I think were like in like the year 2000 or whenever it came out, people just mainstream audiences just weren't really aware of the tropes enough to laugh at it. But I bet if they came out today, it would do well.
Maybe so. Although James Gunn, as I have now learned, I think operates a heck of a lot better when he's on a shoestring. Because I felt this way about his Guardians of the Galaxy films as well. The Suicide Squad would operate a heck of a lot better if it had like a tenth of the budget.
Yeah.
And all of this stuff about killing off your characters and cussing a lot and sort of reveling in the violence would feel a lot more
genuine,
subversive, kind of fun. When it's in this big, slick studio production, you know it has a lot of approval from those up above, and it doesn't feel subversive anymore. It just feels like another one. So
everything that is completely like renegade or murderous or violent or whatever, it does feel like it's carefully selected to be as palatable as possible while being sort of risque. And and you'll notice that, like,
it's a little risque.
Well, it's,
and
like
there's plenty of violence in it.
There's plenty of violence in it, like, and you'll see like King Shark like rip people in half and shit, but at the same time, you know, like, they shy away from the sexuality, don't they? Like, that's something that they're not comfortable showing. Or there's definite calculation here in terms of what James Gunn is allowed to do and what it's not allowed to do. It is worth saying, though, that of the major superhero movies we've had in the last 20 years or so, this is easily the most violent. This is easily the most, like,
And Deadpool.
I guess Deadpool. Yeah. Deadpool. The Deadpool movie. I think even Deadpool isn't as violent as this. I think this is
but
generally
Deadpool
just pretty...
had the advantage of actually feeling a little subversive.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, bothering to break the fourth wall and joke about itself and about genre in a way that the Suicide Squad doesn't.
It was taking the piss out of the whole superhero genre, and this is just taking the piss in general. And that's something that I think I find really frustrating about it. Considering how much money they went into this, considering how much effort, how much time, and how much, you know, just overall space it takes up, it's kind of frustrating how insubstantial it feels. And I'm not saying that it needs to be deep. That's different.
Well, if you're
what I'm
going
saying
to
is I want to feel like I got something out of it.
If you're
going to
put this much time and energy, then maybe it should feel deep. Because, you know, you're showing us these things that are meant to feel sort of large and epic, and the attitude is actually kind of like small and jokey. There's a monster in this film that is very wonderfully realized through some computer special effects. If it were stop motion, it would have been great.
Yeah,
like if they were clearly just trying, like if it looks like the thing from Flesh Gordon.
I've actually never seen Flesh
Gordon. You've never seen Flesh Gordon?
No, okay. It's never come up.
It's practically unwatchable. But
good.
But it's, you know,
what a recommendation.
I've seen it numerous times just because it's that kind of movie that I was delving into a lot in my 20s.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a big stop motion monster that they called in the movie. It's called the Great God Porno. But on the page they called it Nessuaira, which is Harryhausen backwards.
Cute.
Yeah,
cute.
In an homage to Ray Harryhausen.
And I think that's the kind of vibe I was getting off of this. You know, it's people keep bringing up that James Gunn did Troma, and when he was like doing Marvel movies, that was seen as sort of this just like, oh yes, but he grew up, and now it's like, and now he reverted, and I feel like he's trying to evoke all that wildness, but he's doing it. This feels like the straight to video Suicide Squad, where like. There's fewer rules because fewer people would be watching.
Yeah.
And, like, this would be, like, a lower budget, so you just kind of had to rely on whether or not your script and cast were good if you're going to make any sort of impact. But they ended up spending the exact same amount of money on it, and it ultimately doesn't feel... We just reviewed on our Streaming Club podcast, or as we might start calling it, Critically Reclaimed, it's Turkey Shoot, which is an Ozploitation, an Australian exploitation film from 1982... which has actually a very similar tone to this. It's very wild. It's a prison movie. It's an action movie. It's got a lot of horror elements to it. It's very violent. But
that one feels like dangerous, and the wheels are really off of something like Turkey Shoot.
It feels legitimately subversive. When a movie like Turkey Shoot criticizes the government, they mean it. Whereas when in this movie, which is about Americans sending a bunch of supervillains into a South American country to basically undermine their entire government, and like, you know, there's a lot of real world analogs here. They don't want to deal with that. They want to bring it up, but they want to be able to say that they had a subtext, but they never actually want to deal with it. And at the end, they don't want to have any consequences for it.
Yeah.
They don't want to have anything meaningfully said about that other than, world's pretty fucked up, right? And I'm like, yeah, imagine spending like $180 million and getting all of this talent together and having that little to say.
Yeah.
So if this was smaller, I wouldn't care. But it just feels like there's so much on screen. Big and so long that, like...
If it felt nihilistic in some stripe... Like, there's a moment in this film, and I'm not going to give away too much, where the characters have sort of a decision to make. And they can do something noble or do something ignoble. And if they had made the ignoble decision in that minute, and that was the end of the movie, that would have been kind of daring.
That would have been extremely daring. I would have loved that.
Yeah, that would have been a really good ending, in fact. Yeah. Like, well, you know, we were here to do a job, let's just do something ignoble now, and roll credits, and that'll be the end of the movie. The world is an ignoble place. We are supervillains.
Yeah.
We're gonna let the harm befall people because we really just don't care.
Yeah.
And that would have been a wonderfully kind of bitter note to go out on, but
Or even if just some of them had.
Yeah.
If two of them had just done that and just gone and fucked off, and like two of them had tried their best and maybe they died in the process or whatever like that. That's the sort of thing. Everyone wants to, like, evoke the Wild Bunch. No one wants to evoke the ending of the Wild Bunch. No one wants to get to the point where they're, like... Because, like, the characters die here, but it doesn't feel like they die for any reason. Mm. Other than James Gunn thought it would be funny. And briefly, it is. Sometimes it's...
Like, that opening sequence is, you know, a good little shocker of an opening. Yeah,
a little depressing, actually, if you ask me. It was a little... Because I'd already liked a few of those characters, and I was kind of bummed out.
And again, this is. I wish they just put some guy in a mask, but they did this CGI, like, hairless weasel monster.
Oh, yeah, the weasel, yeah.
That is just called the weasel. And, I think if they'd put a guy in a mask or, like, actually had it, like, vomit on people, like, be grosser.
Yeah.
It would have been a lot better. Instead, it just looks like a CGI thing.
I know. There's some good CGI in here, though. I think, the rats look really impressive. Like, there's... I think Starro... Everyone knows it's Starro now.
Oh,
Everyone knows that thing is a... That thing is a weird-looking deal. And, you know what? I think it looks neat.
It looks neat, yeah.
I agree it might be cooler if it was in stop motion, but it still looks neat, and I think they did fun things with the concept. He's kind of a famous DC villain, but it's a little hard to pull off because he's kind of ludicrous.
Yeah,
I
don't know about... I never heard about Starro the Conqueror, but...
One of the first Justice League villains, I think, actually. It goes back really far. And it's the character's been brought back time and time again. So it's all that's all cool and stuff. And I like here's the one of the things that makes this like. And again, I think we're both agreeing that it's kind of entertaining, but it's just we're talking about why it's not great. And I do think that one of the things that elevates this is the cast is really good. Everyone's well cast here. Like Idris Elba is a really great example of someone who can just be the action hero while also being running commentary on it without sacrificing the film.
The relationship between Idris Elba and John Cena was really good.
Yeah,
because John Cena is just sort of this like hateful asshole, and Idris Elba is like, well, I mean, I'm a murderer, but you're insane. And that's sort of their banter. It felt like some things I've seen in The Tick.
Yeah.
That relationship was really fun. There's a sequence where they're sort of competing to see how many people they can murder, which is amusing.
Very fun, and has
kind of a fun coda, but that's just like a tiny bit of the movie.
Yeah. Let's see.
What I'm sensing from this movie, you're comparing it to like the straight-to-video version of Suicide Squad.
Or at least the low-budget, like, you know, Italian spaghetti version.
Yeah,
like,
maybe. Like American.
Americans made Suicide Squad in like 1970, and then Italy made their version in 1972.
You're called Guido, kill yourself, guy.
Yeah, or something like that. But like, you know, there's this whole like long-standing tradition of like Italian knockoff cinema. Sometimes they're as good or better than the original American films, and this feels like the sort of thing where like, yeah, if like Enzo G. Castellari had made this movie in 1972 with a bunch of like American TV actors who fled America because they couldn't get good roles and they could get better stuff in Italy, that would be like, and they would be this, but it would have like 180th the budget,
right.
And it would have been probably really good.
I think this is more like something like Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which I know is very notorious, and I'm not saying that this is like I'm not comparing it to like, it's not a disaster like that, but when I'm watching a film like that, or Ready Player One, or some of Steven Spielberg's latter-day action films, it seems to me like his heart isn't in it. He's exploring a lot of tech, but I'm not getting the same sense of thrill or wonderment that he brought to some of his earlier action films, and I think the reason for that is he as a filmmaker is less interested in that sort of thing. He is more interested in more of his adult dramas, which is why films like Lincoln and The Post and Munich are actually much better thought out, better made movies. I think his heart is in those films.
I think you're right. I think this does feel like James Gunn kind of dashed this off.
Yeah, he was
having fun.
He was asked to do something that I think his heart really isn't in anymore. He's not the trauma guy anymore. He's not 21.
Yeah.
He's not out there to shock people or prove a point. He's there to work for a big studio. He's done several of these. I think he likes making these effects-based studio
films. Not to make this into a Marvel versus DC thing, because who cares, but I think his Guardians of the Galaxy movies, I think he's got more affection for those characters, and he's actually more interested in exploring them as people. Like, I think he, like, Rocket Raccoon is a character that he actually, like, identifies with and wants us to really feel things about. I think Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is a big old sloppy mess of a movie, but I also know that at the heart of it, there's a real, you know, issue here of dealing with, you know, father issues.
Yeah.
And like dealing with someone who happens to have birthed you but isn't the person who raised you, and getting used to that. And I mean, that's a storyline that's been done in movies and TV since the dawn, but like,
well,
it's still something he seemed to really care about, and here I don't think he cares about anything.
But parental issues, especially father issues, are at the core of most superhero stories these days.
A lot. Yeah.
And I'm not
even J.J. Abrams decided to make Star Trek about that.
Yeah. I don't think this is necessarily some sort of grand cultural analysis of the breakdown of the family unit so much as it is lazy writing. We need some sort of motivation, so a lot of screenwriters fall back on tropes.
I also think it's fair to say, I will say this, I do think it's fair to say that there are some themes that a lot of people connect to. I think people who have issues with their parents, that's a very common theme in just in life.
Well, because everybody has parents.
Or they don't, and they have issues with that. But like, the idea of our connection to the people who raised us or failed to raise us or couldn't for some reason, I think that's something that affects a lot of people in the way that they view the world and the way that they view themselves. And it's something that a lot of people feel the need to explore in art. And I don't think that's unreasonable. However, I do think it's fair to say that after a while, you've seen enough of those that it's harder to make them exciting for the audience. because we've seen it done a lot, haven't we? Doesn't mean it's an invalid theme. It just means it's been done a lot, and we're a little used to it now. I'm not complaining that the Guardians of the Galaxy had that theme. I actually think that the fact that it had that theme elevates it above some of James Gunn's other stuff, which doesn't seem to have much of a theme at all, really. Mm. And I think that's more interesting for him to actually see him grow.
Yeah.
As opposed to this, which feels like a bit of a throwback. This is just like, oh, I can do a fun thing with the DC Universe, and there are no rules to speak of, because no one cares about these characters. And he can have a good time. And you know what? I had a good time. It's a fun watch. It's had an entertaining, you know, it's cynicism is a little too immature for my taste sometimes, but I had a really good time with it.
I wanted it to do something with its cynicism.
Sure.
Rather than just have it be kind of gloss over a really, at the end of the day, really typical kind of superhero rescue story. Mm. Its racial politics are a little odd.
Yeah, it's a lot of Americans coming into a South American country to kill non-white people.
And that's not addressed in any kind of way whatsoever. And I think this was the filmmaker's attempt to, like, set it in a place, like, outside of the U.S., like, outside of the world, so they could have this sort of fictional country, but it is a South American country.
Yeah, they don't
and
really.
It resembles a lot of real world politics that they're not talking
about.
That's
my thing. It touches these things. It's like, no, we talked about Americans getting, you know, getting militaristically involved in other countries, and I'm like, yeah, did you say anything about that, or did you just show it and try to make it look cool? Because I think you did the second one, and that's pretty irresponsible.
And another critic pointed this out to me. The character of Harley Quinn commits murder. She has murdered plenty of people over the course of these movies, and she tends to murder people of color, which is a little odd. The number of white people she murdered is very, very low, whereas...
That's not great.
Yeah, and that's a detail that people aren't addressing either.
Well, again, you put them in this movie where almost all the people they can kill are people of color. A, that's a stupid idea. You probably shouldn't have done that. And B... That will tip that scale, won't it? Like, that part sucks.
And you know, that's just irresponsible filmmaking. This isn't the malevolence in filmmaking.
Yeah. Also, I'm going to say this right now, and people have been joking. I heard people joking about this. I don't know what they were talking about. But I've having seen the movie, I get it. A lot of people were joking that James Gunn has something against birds. And I'm going to say it right now, having seen the movie... Yeah, this movie is not kind to birds.
Yeah.
Bad things happen to birds in this movie, all entirely unjustified. It's not like there's an evil bird out there. Like, it's not like you're like, oh yes, good old bird creature is out here killing
one bird has a bomb in it, so we have to kill 100 birds.
I mean, you've got a supervillain who can control rats. Like, why not someone who can control birds or is a bird or whatever? There's, you know, a knockoff version of Hawkman or whatever. You could have done that. No, just actual birds and... Man, they get the short end of that stick.
Yeah.
That's not a good time for birds.
If this were a 45-minute pilot, if it were animated, if it had a really small budget, it would have felt a lot better, but the way it was packaged, it feels like nothing. It feels kind of insubstantial. Yeah. The cynicism is okay. The humor isn't as funny as it ought to be. I should have been having more fun.
Yeah.
And I ultimately only had a little, and that's kind of a pity.
And it's frustrating sometimes because we end up talking about a movie that, you know, has things to recommend it, but the things that they did wrong are kind of distracting, and it's our responsibility to explain not why this is terrible, although I think parts of it definitely are ill-advised. It's our responsibility to explain why it's not great, because it's not. I think it's the sort of thing that, like, yeah, if this were smaller, it would have been a lot more forgivable, but it's just so huge that the fact that this stuff didn't really get thought about or addressed or improved is all the more distracting to me. It's frustrating.
It's a case of they're thinking of the characters and the fun things they can do with the characters more than they are a story, and there's no story to tell other than let's see what we can do with these people. And I know a lot of comic book movies get a lot of traction on that. It's like, what's the story of Wonder Woman 1984? Well, the draw is Wonder Woman. We just want to see her. We want to see her do Wonder Woman stuff.
Wonder Woman 1984 is a frustrating missed opportunity because there's so many things you could have done with setting in 1984. What with, you know, the the advancement of feminism and feminist movements in America, where politics were in America in the Reagan years, the Cold War.
Reagan's a character in it, and it's this weirdly apolitical movie.
Yeah, and there's so many things that they kind of bring out. And like that movie is almost entertainingly weird, but there's so many things that aren't thought out very well in it.
It's very frustrating. And it's another film that has a South American dictator, isn't it?
He's not a dictator. No. Oh. There's a Middle Eastern oil baron.
Okay.
And then there's, the Maxwell Lord.
Okay.
He's not a dictator, although he just tries to rule the world.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's not quite the same thing. But, it's still wonky. Anyway, thank you, PlayStation.
Your DualShock is running low.
No, my DualShock!
Not my DualShock.
Oh, let's move on, and let's talk about another movie that also I don't think tells the story very well. Let's talk about Leos Carax's Annette.
What a curious animal. I saw the Sparks documentary, the Sparks Brothers, which directed by Edgar Wright, which came out earlier this year. Sparks are, in brief, a new wave band. They've been making music pretty steadily since
the
late 60s, I think they started. Wow. Long time. And they are they're a quirky band, brothers Ron and Russell Mayle. Their music has sort of a little bit of a snarky sense of humor to it. There's several layers of irony you have to chip through with every Sparks song, and they've been
I'm of the opinion that Sparks is always at their best when they're being whimsical. And,
yeah,
they've done a lot of whimsical. All I do now is dick around. Yeah. That's one of my favorite Sparks songs.
You're gonna take a walk in the rain and you're gonna get wet, I predict. they're a very playful band, and they've been trying to make a movie for a long time. According to the documentary, they tried to make a movie with Jacques Tati at one point. Mm. That fell through because Jacques Tati was very old. Then they tried to make a movie with Tim Burton. That fell through. And now they finally hooked up with Leos Carax, who I think is a good pair because Leos Carax also has a little bit of a wry sense of humor and probably understands the Sparks tone, and so they've made an opera together.
Yeah, originally the Sparks had done like a theater musical about like the life of Ingmar Bergman, but that ended up not being the project that they made together, and they ended up making this very odd musical about a professional stand-up comedian played by Adam Driver, who is in love with and marries an opera singer played by Marion Cotillard. Bad things happen, and he ends up the sole parent of their daughter, Annette, who is played by a marionette.
A marionette. I don't know if the character is named Mary Annette, but you know the Sparks Brothers like wanted to do that, and they said, let's just say Annette.
Yeah.
The baby is played by a marionette, and the baby grows up, and the Adam Driver character, he's not just a stand-up comedian, he's like a shock stand-up comedian. Yeah. He calls himself, what is it, the Ape of Man?
The Ape of God.
The Ape of God. And he's, tells like shocking, horrible jokes that often get him booed, and he is embroiled in a scandal where there's actually really, one of my favorite musical numbers is when women come forward to accuse him of all of these horrible things that he's done.
Except if you're watching the movie, you can't be entirely sure if that's actually happened or if it's a dream Marion Cotillard had in the back of a limo.
Yeah, because that one of the characters is a marionette, there's a scene where they're lost at sea on a ship and it all looks very artificial because they're making it on a stage and it looks very deliberately like a set. You can't really be sure how much of this is real, how much of it is a dream, or if it's just this big bonkers fantasy.
Except it's not really that bonkers. And one of the things that's frustrating about the movie, this movie's over 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And about half of it is Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard singing the following thing back to each other. We love each other
We're so in love.
We love each other so much.
But this doesn't play like...
We love each other so much.
That repeated refrain doesn't feel like... a movie I actually really hate, Moulin Rouge, where they sing, I'm so in love, I'm so in love. And that's supposed to be incredibly earnest. And she's bumping into things. And... you're supposed to, like, feel the depths of love every time they repeat that refrain. because this is made by such an impish songwriters and such an impish filmmaker, every time they sing it, you buy it less. And that's sort of the point. Every time they say it, you can tell that they don't mean it.
Right. It's not so much that I'm not picking up on that. It's that I don't give a fuck. And that's the thing that's frustrating about this movie. I get what you're going for. And as the story goes on and you start to have a little bit more magic in it and you start to realize just how horrible a person Adam Driver is playing. And we're supposed to be like sort of ramping up, becoming something bigger and more metaphoric. And the first half of this movie, almost nothing happens. And to a point that it's really, really frustrating. It opens with a really good musical number, actually, that's just everyone making the movie agreeing to start making the movie. And that part's really, really wonderful. It's got a lot of energy. And then it loses all of its energy immediately. And we see Adam Driver's stand-up act, which is not funny. Death. It's so awful when you're watching a movie and someone's supposed to be like super creative and a genius, and then you watch it and you can't even pretend.
Well, I thought that was the joke. He's that he's not funny, nobody laughs, he's really sort of offensive. He's not telling jokes.
But people are in it, though, because people are like, the audience is like in the there's a whole musical number where the audience is like responding like to him,
brilliant artist,
and giving him the prompts that he wants. He's manipulating them. They're putty in his hands. They're here to see this, and they seem to be satisfied by it. And at the end, he says, "I killed." Like, it was a successful show, and the show is not a good show. The show is actually a pretty bad show, and I laughed like once. Like, it's not great, and it's not really like well thought out or meaningful. It doesn't really go anywhere. And then she's doing opera, and it's all very sad, and I get it. But then, seriously, it's like they walk around, and then they have sex for a really long time. And then
they sing while having sex.
Yep. And then there's a couple of like clips of like a fake Entertainment Tonight show, because you know how much Entertainment Tonight loves covering opera singers. And then a couple of things that may or may not have happened, and then there's a tragedy, and then like there's like one plot point left for the rest of the movie. And I'm not saying I need my movies to be full of plot. Hell, one of Adam Driver's best movie, probably his best movie, is Patterson, which has next to no plot. But at no point in that movie did I feel like so bored I wanted to like throw my laptop away. And here I was bored. I think the music is drab. I think the storyline is dull. And when it finally does something weird, you've long since lost me. You've long since lost me, and I no longer care.
I think the first half of the movie has the best music. When the least is going on in terms of like story and plot, that's when it's the most exciting.
Yeah.
And it's when they kind of have to move it along in this operatic way that it starts to feel a little contrived. That goes on for far too long.
Way too long.
It's 2 hours and 20 minutes, and I agree. That's too
long
for this
project. There's like
90
minutes of movie in here, if you ask me.
But what I saw was sort of a work of satire. The idea that he goes out, does this unfunny show, and then steps backstage and says, "I killed," is a joke. I saw it as a comedy, like a laugh line. And the fact that Adam Driver is revealed increasingly over the course of the film to be a hideous human being is the gag of the film. Unfortunately, that's such a slight gag, it doesn't warrant all that back-end stuff where he continues to do horrible things.
I don't think it's,
and he's never really called on it.
I get it. You know, I'm watching a movie like Annette, and I honestly believe that one of the most valuable things any critic can do when you're watching a movie that isn't working for you, is asking, is it me? Am I the reason, like, is it my fault for looking at this from the wrong angle? Is there another angle I can watch this movie from that makes it good? Am I maybe looking at it as the wrong genre or the wrong tone? Or do I have a lot of expectations coming in and this is just not what I wanted? And if that's not the movie's fault and I need to rewire myself to get on the movie's wavelength, then maybe I can find a way to make this work. There's no guarantee that you will. But it can potentially save a movie-going experience if you can be self-aware enough to know 20 minutes in, this isn't clicking with me. Is there a way to make it click? I tried really hard. And I thought about it. Is this supposed to be satirical? If it is satirical, it's thuddingly obvious. It doesn't say anything interesting whatsoever about the entertainment industry or relationships. And I find that so empty. And like, even more, like, at least Suicide Squad knows that it's empty. I feel like this one does not. I feel like this one thinks it's saying something interesting, and there's nothing interesting about it.
I think it starts to say something interesting, and then it says it, and then continues to repeat it in more grandiose words, but less impressive ideas.
Yeah.
And it really runs out of steam, like, a lot by the end.
I do want to say I really like Simon Helberg in this.
Oh, is the conductor?
Yeah, he plays Marion Cotillard's accompanist, and he sings about how he wants to be a conductor, and then like 30 minutes later into the movie, we cut to him conducting the orchestra, and he's singing about, now I'm a conductor! And it's pretty great, and he has like a couple of bits where he's talking about the plot and how he feels, and there was apparently a major storyline that we weren't privy to, and then he says, excuse me a moment, and he does a huge bombastic thing, and then he goes back to just being in his own head, and it reminded me a little bit of that Preston Sturges film, Unfaithfully Yours.
Mm-hmm.
You ever see that?
No, I didn't see that one.
It's a great dark comedy about a conductor who thinks his wife is cheating on him. And while he is conducting the orchestra, he's imagining scenarios in his head of how he can murder her because he's so jealous.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the... And they're all weird and funny and ridiculous. And then at the end of the show, he goes back home and tries to put each one into effect, and all of them bomb spectacularly. And it turns out he was wrong about the whole thing. And it's just... all about being inside your own head and like having these like catastrophic fantasies, and it's really quite good. And so like the idea of him being in his own head, thinking about this while he was conducting, for momentarily I was kind of swept up in the movie because I like his character, Adam Stryver's character. I don't give a crap. Marion Cotillard's character is the only thing interesting about her character is there's one bit at the end where Annette is actually able to talk and not just sing. She's old enough to talk. And she actually says something pretty damning to her father, but also about her mother.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, oh, yeah, fair play.
Oh.
You know, like they kind of brought it together a little bit at the end, but not enough to save it.
No, not after. What I appreciate is that this is Sparks finally doing what they wanted to do.
Sure.
I wish they had put more sort of like songs in it. They put only like a lot of these extended arias and things where people are singing scenes to one another. While I appreciate the skill that goes into something like that, I always, even when I'm watching something like Les Miserables, it's like, just stop and talk for a second.
Yeah, we're just kind of,
you don't need to sing this scene. You're just sort of slowing down the dialogue at this point.
You have a bathroom I can use. Yes, we have a bathroom you can use.
Yeah,
do
pretty
I
much.
Need a key? No, we've got a code. What's the code? 4532.
We're just biding our time till master of the house. Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah. If there
Helena
were...
Bonham Carter needed a costume change. Yeah. Had to fill the space somehow.
If there were more, like, if they're going to have all those moments, if there were more, like, bangers throughout, like, things that you could really sort of hum and put on a record and listen to while you're driving, I wouldn't have minded so much. But, you know, I've heard a lot of Sparks songs now, and I want them to give me more. I want more songs.
It's
use old ones. I don't care.
They actually do use a few old ones. Little bits and bobs here and there. But like, and for a moment, it's just like, that's better. That feels like real music. I will say this. I like the opening 5 minutes of this movie a lot.
Also because it's our neighborhood.
Also, it is. It's right up the street.
It's a mile from our house.
Yeah, like we could walk there like really easily. I didn't know they were filming that. That's hilarious.
Up on Santa Monica Boulevard.
That's like the best mole restaurant in town. Mm. And like that's where we get our art supplies. Yeah. And, ooh, the Naan Hut. The Naan Hut is a really great underappreciated restaurant.
They're across the street from the bank and Lemley's Royal Theater.
Yeah, yeah. So that was kind of fun, but also just that's the best song in the movie. You peaked way too early. It's a lot like La La Land, where like that opening, like Another Day of Sun, is such a great number, and it's so like
about Los Angeles and traffic,
and it's so vividly realized, and it's actually got like some ambitious choreography and everything like that. And then and then the movie just loses a lot of energy after that, and this one loses all of its energy after that. And I really just did not connect with this at all. I see what they were getting at. I found it spectacularly uninteresting.
I appreciate its sense of humor. I agree with you that it runs out of energy eventually. I was carried along for about the first half.
Okay.
I appreciate that they're doing something a little weird. I wish they had gone weirder.
Yeah.
There was a lot more they could have done with this premise. Given what I know about Leos Carax and about Sparks, I know that they're capable of a lot stranger, and I wish that they had gone deeper and further.
Well, tell me about the other musical that you watched this week. I didn't get to see Vivo, the new animated musical, with songs by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who, of course, did the In the Heights and Hamilton. How is Vivo?
I like Vivo a lot.
Yay!
Speaking of good music carrying a movie along, I feel that way about Vivo. I guess I'm a Lin-Manuel Miranda stan now.
Yeah.
Because I didn't see Hamilton until it aired on Disney Plus, and I just fell in love immediately. And then I saw In the Heights, and I adore In the Heights. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in this one, Lin-Manuel Miranda plays a Kinkajou, who is part of a performing duo on the streets of Havana with an elderly guitarist. The guitarist is played by, let me look up the cast here.
I do not know. You can do it. I believe
Juan de Marcos Gonzalez.
Got it.
And yeah, they perform on the streets, and Lin-Manuel Miranda is the rapping Kinkajou. And if you were to tell me that there's a CGI movie with a rapping Kinkajou, like last year, I'd say, get that thing away from me. but it's Lin-Manuel Miranda rapping, and I have a weakness for the way he rhymes. So I really enjoyed this. When the elderly owner likes to reminisce about his glory days and how he had a...
By the way, a Kinkajou is like kind of like a
it's like a
raccoon,
it's like
a
lemur. Yeah, it's like an arboreal yeah. creature.
They're very adorable. They're very adorable.
Yeah, look up a picture of a Kinkajou. Yeah, they're really cute.
Kinkajou. Mm. Yeah, just I realize that's kind of an esoteric animal.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, Andres, the main character, in his glory days had an affair with Marta, played by Gloria Estefan. And they've been separated for many, many years. She's been performing in Florida. He's been in Cuba. And when he passes away, rather unexpectedly, it's up to Vivo, the Kinkajou, to deliver a song that he wrote for her to her in Florida. So aww. It's up to the Kinkajou to go to Florida and deliver the song. Vivo can... We hear him speak, but the other people can't hear him speak. So he's running sort of like Garfield-like dialogue, or he's running commentary on the human world. He ends up falling in with a young girl named Gabby, who's played by a newcomer named Inerali Simo. And she's really great. She has a number about how she wants to be a drummer. And they end up teaming up and to deliver the song to Gloria Estefan. There are a few cliched cartoon things, like when the Kinkajou gets lost in the woods and starts talking to other animals, that it just becomes death.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to see them escape the snake. I don't want to see the loving spoonbills sing a song. That's not interesting to me.
The loving spoonbills?
Yeah.
That's kind of funny. I can work with that.
There's
That's,
a pair of spoonbills in there.
I would not be
able
if you
story,
pitch, if I'm executive producing this movie and you pitch that to me, I'd be like, "All right, here's a check.
I'll give you that one.
Don't.
I'm gonna slide it slowly, but
back,
I'm still gonna slide it.
Don't come
you.
Back until all the money has been spent."
It's slight, but it's incredibly lively, and I do love the music.
Yeah.
The design is okay. It as a visual treat, you know, it's very colorful in the way a lot of these animated films are, but the best visuals come from the flashback and the dream sequences, because they're animated in 2D, and they do like these very stylized block, colorful block style,
right?
And the rest is all CG.
Okay.
So yeah,
nice.
Those flashbacks are really beautifully created. I wish more films just did it.
Just that's weird.
Do it
like,
in 2D.
I've seen
I'm
so
fine.
Many like CG movies that have like 2D sequences, and like I remember like when Sherlock Gnomes came out, and they had these like really interesting like bits where like Sherlock Gnomes would like deduce things and like go into his memory palace or like whatever, and it just started all of a sudden it looked really interesting and like really exciting and like all kinds of dazzling like designs and everything like that. I'm like, great, why is this in CG? Because the CG makes it look like crap and your 2D looks awesome.
Yeah,
there's
a flashback sequence in
for the computers. We got to use the computers, I guess.
I think it's the seventh Harry Potter film where they tell the origin of like these three mystical objects.
Oh, the Deathly Hallows. And
that's realized through this really kind of bizarre looking animated sequence.
Yeah,
and they clearly hired a different team, and it's all like these stick men and everything sort of shadowy. And that was really cool looking. It's like, oh, well. You know what? I would be okay if the film went from being live action to being like the series just all of a sudden was animated.
I'm telling you, it's only a matter of time before they do like an animated reboot of that. Like, imagine if it's Harry Potter, but like they do it as a TV series, one book per season.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, granted, I don't want to give J.K. Rowling any more money right now, but I think it's only a matter of time before they decide that like everyone was like so unhappy with all the stuff they had to cut out of each book anyway. That way you wouldn't have to cut anything out.
Flesh it all out.
And if it's animated, you don't have to worry about like actors like growing up too fast. Mm. So I think that's inevitable. Yeah, I really think that's only a matter of time.
I mean, a lot of these films are so much CGI anyway. We're going to have animated characters. It's only going to be... I know a lot of actors are putting stipulations in their contracts now that their likenesses like, can or cannot be used like 50 years down the line.
Robin Williams brilliantly did that. He made a thing where it's like, after I'm dead, you can't use like pre-recorded stuff of me to make new stuff. It's one of the reasons why the original plan for that live-action Aladdin was they were going to use Robin Williams' original recordings and outtakes, and it would just be a CGI genie. And that would have been totally tasteless.
That was the plan,
and then but it was in Robin Williams' contract. There's a certain, I think it's 30 years for him or something like that. But like after his death, you can't do that.
Yeah, I know.
You can't just exploit him like that. And good for him.
I know.
God, I miss Robin Williams.
So in the case, we're off Vivo. Vivo is good. It's lively. Like I said, it's pretty slight, but I love, again, it's a slight movie with really good music in it, and that carries it a long way.
Have you been like humming it to yourself?
Yeah, like the beat of my own drum song, I can actually hum back. Nice. And there's something about Lin-Manuel Miranda's rapping. Like
He's really clever with wordplay.
He's got really good rhyming structure, and he raps in a way like he's constantly running out of breath, mm-hmm. which makes it sound kind of sort of like frantic and fun. So I actually like the way he raps.
Yeah.
When he's Lin-Manuel Miranda, the rapping Kinkajou movie is pretty good, actually. Who'd have thunk it?
That's great.
The big, broad, experimental opera from the 80s New Wave band is a somewhat of a bust, but yeah.
The
animated film about the rapping Kinkajou film is doing it for me now.
Which just goes to show you, you never know.
You never know.
If you had asked us, like, before we go, which one of those is probably the better film, we might assume that the director of Holy Motors would probably be the better one. But no, you cannot have anticipation. You cannot like decide in your head what the narrative is going to be. You just got to let the movie tell you.
Yeah. It's on Netflix. Go ahead and watch Vivo. I know that Lin-Manuel Miranda has signed a contract. I think he's making a whole bunch of movies for Netflix now.
Good.
In this caliber, sort of like he's writing a bunch of songs for like animated films.
Great. I'm down.
I like him as a songwriter. He hasn't disappointed me yet. So yeah, go for it.
All right. Excuse me. Late. Fighting a yawn there. I'm just tired.
Sorry, my reviews can keep you so scintillated.
No, it's fine. I'm sorry. I tried to hide it from the podcast audience. I can't hide anything from you. All right, one last film to review, and there's no good segue here, like at all. There's nothing. There's no connected tissue. This is a documentary from Lucy Walker. Lucy Walker had previously directed Oscar-nominated documentary shorts. She had what was it called? It was like the something something and the something something. It was
great. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
She did a film called Wasteland, and she did a film called The Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom, which I remember very vividly.
Wasteland, was that about the people who make art out of garbage and live in it? Yeah, I've seen that one.
I saw
Wasteland.
Both of them were Oscar nominated, so we both saw them. And then Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom was about the tsunami in Japan. She's British, and she had moved to California, and she decided to make a documentary about how wildfires have been escalating in California over the last 10 years or so.
If you live here, you know that.
Well, if you live here, you know that. If you live anywhere, you know that. Wildfires are starting to become a really global phenomenon. I mean, it's always been an issue. Mm-hmm. It's always been something that can and did happen, but it's been escalating a lot. We just had one of the worst wildfires in, I think it might actually still be going, the Dixie Fire.
Yeah, I think
it's one of the worst fires we've ever had in California.
And I think the worst fire we've ever had in California, we've had like five of those in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And the one, this is a documentary about like the deadliest day, where it was the campfire. Which is the name of it. That's what they call it. Up in Northern California. And then there were two other ones. And then there was a really bad one in Malibu. Greece has been going through this. Australia had an apocalyptic wildfire, I think it was last year. And they show some footage from that at the beginning of this movie, Bring Your Own Brigade, that honestly had me in tears. It's basically, it was just like showing this koala who was like being burned and everything like that, people trying to save it, and it's like, this is like 5 minutes into the movie and I'm in tears. Oof. Because it's just so brutal. So I just want to let you know, there's some really harsh stuff in this movie. They blur out the images of dead bodies, but they talk a lot about how, like, firefighters are trying to save people, and now their job after the fire is done is to sift through the ashes and try to find the skeletons of the people they tried to save yesterday. And, like, it's really brutal. And they show footage of, like, you know, like, horses who didn't make it, and it's, like, it's... It's for a reason. Mm. Like, it's there to, like, make you realize the severity of this. I get it. I'm not saying it's irresponsible, but it is... It could really overload your senses. And if that sounds like it's way too much for you, I totally get it. I just want you to know about that going in, because it's very front-loaded, all that imagery. And basically, Lucy Walker is putting you with as much footage as possible, like, of the actual event and people within the event, showing you just how absolutely horrifying it is to be trapped, caught in a wildfire, and how quickly they can completely overtake a town. And people are trying to evacuate, and they had all these evacuation plans. Okay, here's what happens if we need to evacuate Zone 8. Here's what happens if we need to evacuate Zone 4. They had no plan to evacuate every single person in the county simultaneously, because no county is laid out like that.
Yeah.
So people are trapped in traffic jams, and they're feeling their cars starting to melt. And it's horrifying. And that's about the first third of the movie. The rest of the movie is basically like, okay, many people made it. Quite a few people did not. More property damage than we can possibly describe. People have lost memories, loved ones, pets. Now what do we do? Well, there's a lot of people trying to rebuild, people opening their homes up to other people. Isn't that lovely? But we also need to figure out why this is happening and how to prevent it from happening at least as badly ever again. And it would seem that the obvious solution to this is climate change, but that's really only part of it. And I'm glad that this documentary focuses on other stuff too, because that's all real. That's an important factor here. But there's also a lot of things that human beings are doing that are making it worse than it even needs to be. Like, for example, the logging industry, when they remove all the trees from the area and log them, they're supposed to plant more. They plant them so densely that now when one thing gets on fire, everything gets on fire really fast because they're too close together. So there's no, like, distance between them. Everything is guaranteed to go up into kindling. And they're basically planting trees that are the trees you make matchsticks out of. Which is, like...
literally trees to be burned.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like, it's not a smart plan. And so we're talking about stuff like that. But the thing that ends up being just absolutely maddening, and it feels... it would be comical if it wasn't so sad, is you start the movie with all of these, like, horrifying depictions of people who are desperate to leave their houses and are trying to, like, save their own lives, and they're worried about their loved ones and loved ones who die. And then the last two thirds of the movie are about, like, firefighters and local politicians trying to pass regulations that would prevent this from ever happening again. And all of those same people we saw at the beginning of the movie voting against it. It's like, oh, okay, like, well, one of the problems in the Malibu fire was that there weren't enough firefighters to go around, so we've had a bill on the docket that would have raised the budget for firefighters, and everyone voted against it because no one wanted to pay more taxes. There's a thing on there's a ballot initiative they want to put in the small town that got decimated by the campfire. There's, you know, the firefighters are trying to say, like, okay, if we do these 10 things, we can dramatically reduce the danger of wildfire. We can't prevent a wildfire from ever happening, but we can prevent it from being this apocalyptic ever again if we do these 10 things. And everyone's like, no, that sounds like a lot of work. And it's like, okay, well, here's, like, the one thing. If we all do this one thing and it doesn't cost anything, we can all potentially survive this a lot more easily. And it's to make sure that between your house and anything in your garden that would be kindling, like flowers or wood chips or anything like that, there's a 5-foot divide. It's not necessarily how we aesthetically design our houses and like them to be, but it will prevent them from being caught up in forest fires, which attack here constantly. And everyone is, and you see this, like, city council meeting where people are just like, they're trying to stop our community from being quirky. I love my rose bushes. They're a big part of my home. And I'm like, you don't have a home anymore.
I'm learning because you had rose bushes. I'm learning more and more how much of politics is based very pointedly on trying to do as little as possible. Like, this should be easy. We shouldn't have to do this stuff. If something's work, no. Yeah. And this is beyond party. This is just sloth.
That's one of the arguments they even had. It's just like, I don't know if I want to, like, the police to walk around, like, giving people tickets for not having, for having flowers in front of their house. We're not going to do that. So I'm voting against it. And I'm like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And again, I almost wish this had, like, if this had, like, ended with, like, another blaze, like, at the end of it. Not that I want any harm to fall people, but if we just, like, there are more wildfires to show. Because it just needs to show that there are things we can do.
Mm.
And not just, like, I know, like, sometimes it's hard to look at, like, climate change as anything other than, like, an existential crisis. Like, what can we do now? And the answer is not a lot right now that's going to have, like, we can't just flip a switch right now. We have to put in a lot of work so that in generations things might improve, or that we can at least prevent them from getting worse. But people, just as a species, we tend to be very short-sighted, and we only care about what's right in front of us.
Yeah, it's difficult to make intergenerational plans.
Exactly. And so, and I get that. That's hard. But at the same time, these are things we can do right now. This is actual stuff that would have tangible results, and we could do it right now.
Mm.
But you don't want to re-landscape the front of your house. And as a result, your house and possibly you and all of your possessions to boot could go up in flames at a moment's notice at any time. We have a tendency to vote against our own self-interests because it seems like too much work.
Yeah.
And that's something that you watch this movie and it's like, it's horrifying. It's horrifying to watch the fires, but it's equally horrifying to see people basically vote against their own self-interests. Mm-hmm. And I don't get it. And I really don't get it. And I'm sure there are elements of my life where I've done this too.
Mm-hmm.
And I really need to fucking stop doing that because, yeah, we are fucked if we don't get our shit together and actually, like, agree to do some things for the common good. And not even complicated things. Simple things.
Yeah, it's...
Wear a mask, by the way.
It's hard. It's considered hard work to care about others and be decent. And a big flavor of our recent political history in this country is it's okay not to care now. That was a big part of the Trump administration.
Yeah, validated people's selfishness.
It's difficult to care about others.
Anyone who says they care about others is being disingenuous.
You're either being disingenuous or when I was growing up, they accused you of being a bleeding heart. That was the phrase that was bandied about. You're just a bleeding heart.
Nothing could be worse than caring.
It's like you're caring. Why are you putting all of this effort into caring for others? It's fine. You don't have to do the work. So this
always
idea
look out
of,
for number one.
Look out for number one. And, you know, you look at somebody like Donald Trump who's never cared about anything other than himself.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's sort of become this godhead for the people who feel like it's okay not to care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is bleeding into a lot of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And if we try to make any kind of leeway, people do vote against their interests. Even with something as basic as, let's prevent forest fires.
Yeah.
There's no bad guy here. Fire is the bad guy.
Yeah. Well, but that's the other thing I do appreciate. I just want to say this. The appreciate the thing about the documentary is that they actually talk about how fire is not the bad guy.
Yeah.
Fire is symptomatic of a problem that, first off, there have been forest fires since before anything.
Hmm.
Lightning has caused forest fires, for God's sake. Like, just forest fires is a thing that happens. It's supposed to be a natural part of nature. You know, things are eliminated so that life can grow.
Hmm.
That's something that's just very common. It happens all the time. And they talk about how, like, when, you know, before the Europeans got to America, the people here would often... People think about, like, you know, like, oh, America was this untamed wilderness. It was very tamed. People knew how to control the environment, and one of the things that they would actually do is they would have controlled burns to remove... Because right now, if you don't do that, you're basically just leaving kindling out in the woods. You're basically just leaving fuel out there that's going to combust, and it's all going to get worse and worse the longer you wait. So there was an understanding that fire was actually something that was important to keep the ecosystem alive and humanity alive. But Europeans didn't come from a place... Well, Europe doesn't have the same forest fire problems that America does, at least not all of it. And so the documentary talks about how when Europeans came to America, the prevailing philosophy was all fire is bad. All fire must be stopped. All fire must be prevented. Mm. But that's short-sighted because it means that when there is a fire, the fire has that much more to burn. And that's something that we need to regret. We need to move back on. We need to pull back on that and realize that that's not a healthy attitude about how to handle the environment. So it's a very good documentary. I felt like I learned something, which is nice. I wasn't just like trying to like, you know, make me feel like everything I already know is correct, which I think is important in a documentary. It has harsh lessons. It has harsh things to see. And I think the opening in particular is just painful. And to the extent that I can't recommend that to everybody, but I do think it's a very good documentary. Mm. And so when we're reviewing our films on the critically acclaimed scale, our scale, once again, is from C minus to C plus. Most films are average, and average is a C. C minus is below average. That's anything we just generally don't recommend, or maybe we think it's terrible, but just anything in that range. And C plus is above average, things that we genuinely recommend. Maybe we think they're classics, or maybe we just think they're pretty good. On that note, I'm going to give Bring Your Own Brigade a C plus.
Okay.
It's definitely not for all constitutions, but I do think it's a vital documentary, and I'm glad I saw it. On that note, Vivo.
Vivo is a high C. Okay. It's no animated classic, but I did enjoy watching it.
Fair.
And the story is okay, but the music is really good, and I like that. Fair enough. Carries it a far.
I liked it more than that, actually. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Annette, C minus. I can't in good conscience recommend that you see this. It's such a bummer of a movie.
I do give it a C just because I appreciate when this kind of odd experiment is at least is even tried.
Yeah.
And the degree of success was enough that it didn't fail entirely. I think it is too long. I think it runs out of energy at the end, but there's enough of a sense of humor and enough of a quirk here to recommend it.
I think there's about 8 solid good minutes in this movie, and 5 of them are at the first 5 minutes. I really just could not get it. I could not get into this one at all. And I get that they tried something big. I think that your success matters a bit more than that.
This is not a helpful phrase, but it's not for everyone.
Well, true. Yeah. All right. Well, I'll just leave it there. And the Suicide Squad.
It's not a total bust, but it's also not something I would want to necessarily encourage others to watch. So
this is an interesting one because I feel like for me, this is a C, not because it's mediocre, but because I feel like the good and the bad just average out.
Yeah, you know, that's a good way to put it.
Like, there's a lot of good character work here. There's some memorable bits and scenes and action. I certainly laughed. There's a lot of things that I enjoyed, but I enjoyed it so superficially, and all of the things that bring the movie down are just cynical and immature and at least casually racist. And I just, you know, you can't really support that. And so it averages out to a very mixed bag.
I wish it were more immature. I wish it were really kind of just adolescent and gross.
I don't mind immature. It's cynically immature rubs me the wrong way.
Okay.
You know, like, I think if you can be immature and just be having fun with it. Mm. And then there's immature, but, like, we're propagating kind of, like, a negative worldview. And at that point, I just feel like, who's this for?
All right.
How is this helping anything? It's not even escapist at that point. It's just kind of sad. So that's not quite what this movie is, but I feel like it tilted in that direction.
You know, cynical teens need movies as well, but I don't think it has that bad attitude. I don't think it has enough of a point of view to have a bad attitude. I think it sort of shies away into positivity far too quickly, despite all of its profanity and despite all of its violence. It never tilts into anything threatening or entertainingly vulgar. It feels really safe to me, and that's the disappointing part. It's a C, but it's a very dispassionate C. It's, you know, a head and shoulders above David Ayer's Suicide Squad movie, but you know, the bar was on the floor for that one.
Ain't that the truth? All right. Well, in any case, that is it for Critically Acclaimed this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You're awesome.
Yeah.
You're just really great, and we think you're the best, and it means a lot to us that you're here with us and enjoying these, trying to enjoy these movies with us. We can't guarantee we'll
watching movies along with us, perhaps.
But in any case, we'll be back next week with reviews of films.
It's kind of what we do.
Yeah, we got Don't Breathe 2 coming up. and other things as well. I don't actually know what I'm going to be able to get to this week, but we'll try our best, won't we?
Don't breathe too. Surely there was like, keep not breathing or hold your breath. There could have been a cleverer title.
I'm sure. Breathe this time. Now
breathe even less.
Should be don't breathe too.
Don't breathe.
At least look who's talking this thing. Come on. Don't breathe now. In any case, but anyway, that's what's coming up and other things as well. We have a show. Where am I going here?
We have a whole network, in fact. Yeah. You can subscribe to the Critically Acclaimed Network. You can get, if you're a subscriber, each one of our tiers within the subscription service gets you access to more and more shows. If you can't get enough of us, boy howdy, we're trying to provide.
Yeah, we got shows where we reviewed the 1960s Batman, every single movie ever nominated for Best Picture, every single episode of Star Trek. We just started doing The Next Generation. And these are all at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We also have polls for future episodes of our various programs, hangouts online, the works. And of course, if you can't afford to support the show that way, we totally get it. We're very grateful for all of our patrons, without whom our shows wouldn't exist. But if you want to help the show in other ways, leave us a review, subscribe, tell a friend. All those things help. You can also check out the Soap Store run by myself and M. Lapis da Silva. Follow us on Twitter at SaltCatSoap, or on Instagram at SaltCatSoap. There's a link to the store right there. It's on Etsy, SaltCatSoap. We just released a whole bunch of new designs for August, and they smell amazing. So please check them out. They're really, really nice. Whitney still has another podcast as well. We don't talk about this as often
as
we
should.
That's
true. Over on The Screen's Margins, B. Peterson's podcasting network, I do a weekly podcast with them. We're taking a week off next week, but we'll be back the week after that. It's called All About Ovid, all spelled with O's. The least Googleable podcast title of all time. They and I talk about what we saw that week on Ovid, the streaming service, which is like deep cut art house stuff. We discuss Best of Fest, which is a dance short festival all about dance shorts in the last episode. We talk about the Cordillera of Dreams, the most recent film from Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman, who makes a lot of films about Chilean politics. And we have a lot of interest. And we talk about The Green Knight as well, because we had thoughts on The Green Knight.
Oh, good.
That's not on Ovid, but you know, we decided to sandwich it in there.
Why not? It's your show. Do whatever you want.
Yeah. So go check out The Screen's Margins, run by B. Peterson.
And of course, we're on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at Lane Bibiani.
I am at Whitney Seibold.
If you want to email us and talk about anything we discussed in this episode, ask us questions, whatever, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. You might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. And I think that's about that. So thank you, everybody, for listening. We think you're amazing. And never forget, everyone, yes, everyone, is a critic.
I'm sorry, what?